Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions. The audiobook version is broadcast with permission from Blackstone Audio.
He advanced the slide to show a handshake between a white hand and a Native American one. Empathy. He looked at them, then launched back into his story. The surest defense against this sort of predator is a hand reached out in friendship. This makes clear that you are not doing what he is accusing you of. And it protects you in court later on. He ran through a series of slides illustrating the bank's outreach to the Native community. We donate to the Indian College Fund. We sponsor the Native Night Out Against Crime on the reservation. We're a sponsor of the reservation high school sports teams. We try to be a good neighbor in the community. That kind of outreach, that empathy, was doubly important in this guy's case. He had been a banker himself, right here in Minneapolis, before moving back to the reservation. In fact, he probably had more CE credits than most people in this room. And make no mistake, a legally sophisticated opponent is by far the most dangerous. So, preemptive community outreach. But there was still a question. Why would he accuse us of redlining if he was just trying to get a personal loan? The man must have successfully navigated the line between race and business for years in Minneapolis. He had to know that barking at me like that would set off red flags. So what do you think? Was he trying to entrap us? J.W. paused and scanned the room while they thought. When you don't know the answer to a question like that, he said, and most times you don't, there is still one good defense. More empathy. I really empathize with members of your band, I told him. How frustrating it must be, dealing with people like Sam Schmeeker and what can seem like a double standard. He was disarmed. His whole posture changed. Redlining is illegal, I told him, and worse, it's wrong. I'm sorry if Sam offended you. For what it's worth, I said, I do know that was definitely not his intent. Those last four words are critical under Regulation B of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. Repeat after me. Definitely not our intent. He conducted the audience in the recitation. Good. The slide changed to one showing the phrase. J.W. looked around the room at his audience. The balding banker by the window was confused. So you approved the loan? J.W. shook his head. No. This is where the risk of the reservation we discussed earlier comes into play. It has nothing to do with him or with race, okay? So forget all that. What matters is Regulation B, which says, and I quote, "The act and regulation may prohibit a creditor practice that is discriminatory in effect because it has a disproportionately negative impact on a prohibited basis, even though the creditor has no intent to discriminate and the practice appears neutral on its face, unless the creditor practice meets a legitimate business need that cannot reasonably be achieved as well by means that are less disparate in their impact." Okay, it's the legitimate business need we are talking about. I'm not trying to discriminate, and I'm not racist. In fact, I help the Native community. I do outreach. I give them money. But my job is to protect my bank's assets. I have a legitimate business need to do that, or I can't continue banking. I can't assume someone can't pay, but I can point to the legal problems inherent in lending on an Indian reservation. So I told him, "Your reservation is a domestically dependent sovereign nation, and as such, it does not have to recognize certain federal laws with regard to foreclosures." He immediately objected. J.W. shot up a strident finger, assuming Eagle's role again. But I cut him off. "Of course I want to help you. We're in the business of making loans, right? Be silly not to. And frankly, we'd be absolutely crazy not to want to do business with a customer with your credit history. But, I said, I need you to help me. How can I do that? He asked. And I said, very simple. Very easy. J.W. held his hands open as he reenacted the encounter. His eyes shone. As a condition of the loan, you sign a waiver that prohibits you and your band from using their sovereign status as a shield to avoid legal disputes filed in United States courts. If you default, we have a right to acquire a portion of tribal land. Can I have Sam prepare that for us? J.W. strolled across the seminar room as they contemplated the legal maneuver he had just described. Jorgensen watched from his place against the wall. J.W. knew that this is what Jorgensen had invited him to the conference to do. He had told J.W. he would make sure that every president and vice president from every Capital Bank Holdings branch in Greater Minnesota was in this room. Jorgensen couldn't say these things himself, not in his position, but he wanted J.W.'s methods to become wider practice as the chain expanded its holdings in communities near casinos. Reducing the downside was absolutely essential to his expansion plan, and improving the performance of the Greater Minnesota banks overall was the key to his campaign to be named CEO when the old man retired. It stood to reason that such a development would also be very good for his old protege, J.W. Typically, J.W. went on, the native customer will reject this condition for legal or, more often, emotional reasons, as you can understand. These structural legal conflicts are a sad part of our country's legacy, something none of us should be satisfied with. We have simply got to do better. But tribes are domestically dependent sovereign nations. They own reservation land collectively, not as individuals. And as bankers, it's neither your fault that it is this way, nor your responsibility to fix it. You can't change the legal system or the very unfortunate history of the United States when it comes to the treatment of Native Americans. You are required to work within it, and you have a legitimate business need to protect your customers' assets to the best of your ability. Now I'll look for an answer from a brave soul. J.W. faced the audience, his hands in his pockets. Is this redlining? Is it a crime? His shirt was a brilliant white, his tie a lavender slash. He was almost done, and on time. Just a few minutes left for them to understand, his lessons slipping into their thinking, their mental scales tilting. Finally, the balding banker replied in a voice that was barely audible. No, he said. It isn't. His look admitted the truth of this, but nevertheless he seemed defeated by it. J.W. saw Jorgensen make a note in his cell phone as he watched the man's reticence. Jorgensen viewed anyone who wasn't adamantly in support as a bitter enemy and someone to purge. It was his one major weakness. J.W. gave a slow, gentle nod. No, the gentleman is right. He is absolutely correct. This is not redlining. This is business. You have left the choice up to the customer. Remember, this is the free market. You are using an inherent conflict in federal law to protect your assets, which you are obligated to do as a fiduciary. And, incidentally, any choice the customer makes, you win. You can protect your bank, which is your depositors' funds, your community's funds, and you can make money. You have reduced your exposure to risk and hung on to your casino deposits. The room was silent. A tone sounded, and a female announcer's voice came on over the room's speakers. This concludes our afternoon breakout sessions, she said. Please join us for a wine and cheese reception in the Pocahontas room. For a moment, the bankers remained in their chairs, mulling ethics, profits, and legality. It was, as J.W. had said, a new era. The buzzword at the conference was aggregation, which meant cobbling many small victories together into larger portfolio gains. It's what the big boys were doing, and it required intelligence and agility at the margins, the very qualities JW was talking about. The law was no longer a simple set of boundaries to the playing field. It was sports equipment to be used in the game. Community bankers needed to get more aggressive or they were going to get eaten for lunch. They had to remember their role. They weren't legislators or social workers. They weren't there to right the greater wrongs of society. They were bankers. And as the plenary speaker had said in the morning keynote, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Jorgensen shifted off the wall. He drew his hands from his pockets and started to clap. The bankers glanced over at him and then joined in. He walked down the steps along the wall as the applause continued. The bankers gathered up their briefcases and swag bags and began to mill out. "John White," he said, stepping up to the table, "you are a strategic genius." J.W. smiled wryly and coiled his power cord. "I guess that's why you made me branch president." Jorgensen laughed. "Guilty as charged. You got time for a grain belt?" J.W. looked at the clock and winced. "I told Carol I'd be home for dinner. It's a 4-hour drive. Can I take a rain check?" He saw a cloud pass briefly across Jorgensen's face. Then it was gone. Jorgensen smiled and nodded. "Yeah, sure. How is that beauty queen?" "Oh, you know Carol. Always into something." The two of them walked out onto the mezzanine where conference goers were congregating in small groups or speaking with industry reps at display tables along the walls. Like royals, they strolled toward the glass balcony and rode the escalator to the vast atrium below. They shook hands at the bottom, and then J.W. pushed his way out into the afternoon sun. It was bright and hot, and as he turned, he could still see Jorgensen, a ghost beyond the glare of the plate glass, standing there watching, with a hand in his pocket. For an instant, his expression seemed almost malevolent. But then the glare shifted, and Jorgensen smiled and waved. J.W. waved back and stepped across Nicollet Mall, heading towards his parking ramp. Chapter 2. Jorgensen's expression stayed with J.W. as his dirty white caprice made its way north and west into a purple-orange sunset. He had left the interstate just before Duluth and taken a 4-lane divided artery that angled off into the North Country. After an hour, it lost its median and came together, squeezing its way into a small town and finally ending at a flashing red light. J.W. turned onto a narrow, 2-lane capillary that shot out past a Cenex station and a Dairy Queen. 3 people in line at the small yellow window, a handful of kids romping on a red picnic table, a girl crying over a dropped cone on the sidewalk, long light in her blonde curls. And then he was out into the rolling farm fields and sudden bluffs of Minnesota's Iron Range. The region's iron and taconite mines had sprouted dozens of little towns full of Finns, Croats, Cornish, and Italians, all of them stout, resilient people who could cheerfully survive decades stooped in tunnels moiling with pickaxes so long as they had beers and pasties and the love of friends and good women. An hour ahead, in one of those range towns with its little Victorian houses covered in asbestos shakes, his wife Carol and their 13-year-old daughter Julie were waiting for him. The road plunged into an area of glacial moraines. The sun lit the tops of the domes and angled long brown fingers into the valleys. Columns of shadowed geese piled down onto shimmering lakes, forming dark, squabbling islands. Wetlands grew damp beards of fog. For the first part of the drive, J.W. had listened to an audiobook called The Power of Habit about whether or not we have free will. It was a question that had come to occupy him recently. He had started listening to science books like this when Julie was 8 or 9, and he ordinarily loved them, but tonight he kept reaching up to turn the player off. The feral look in Jorgensen's eyes kept coming back to him. He wondered if he had imagined it, or if he had overlooked something important in their parting exchange about getting a beer. He hoped he hadn't missed a career opportunity. He and Carol were tight on money, and if a new opportunity to help Jorgensen had been in the offing, he should have stayed and gotten the beer. Even though Carol was expecting him, she would have understood. Each time he turned the player back on, the worry boiled back up, and he turned it off again to think things through. He finally unrolled the windows to let the grassy air fill the car and buffet his ears with noise. Jorgensen was going to make a play for CEO when the old man retired. Maybe this had been a chance for the upper executives to feel JW out, to see if he could fill Frank's shoes managing the greater Minnesota branches. If that was the case, Carol wouldn't want to move. She loved North Lake. He wondered if he could somehow manage things from there. After his dad was laid off from Reserve Steel, JW remembered, he had taken a job selling leases for cell phone towers. The job had him on the road a lot, but he had made it work. "How do you know when you're up north?" his dad used to ask farmers in order to loosen them up. "There's no sign announcing it, but you know you're there when the Dairy Queen sells bait." It always got a laugh. On the other hand, maybe Frank had discovered the loan he had made to himself and wanted to discuss it in private. A spike of anxiety shot through him. That would explain the predatory quality J.W. thought he had seen in his eyes. As he drove onward, his mind swung from one possibility to the other. He decided to call Jorgensen in the morning to apologize and to see if the conversation led anywhere. The stakes were high. North Lake was a torn-up town after the mines closed, and many of the workers who lost their jobs and their pensions still pined for the old days. There still wasn't as much opportunity as there had been. It was during this aftermath that he and Carol had first fallen in love, a love that was in many ways responsible for his working for Jorgensen now. Carol Ingersoll was the daughter of one of the town's most respected families. With fine blonde hair swept over her low forehead, her round blue-gray eyes and knobby nose, her wide neck and button chin, she wasn't a classic beauty, but she had an angular jawline and plush lips, so she was thought of as the town beauty nonetheless. She was popular and personable. She was believed to be smart, and she was at the top of the social food chain. J.W., on the other hand, was a scrappy 17-year-old horse trainer, a loner in school with middling grades, who worked to make extra money to support himself during the long stretches when his dad was away on the road. He thought about the moment of their meeting. He was delivering a mare from Fredrickson's barn to Olson's stables, which was the more upscale horse barn that catered to lake people from the Twin Cities. Everybody was trying to figure out ways to make money off the lake people. The Main Street businesses had even started selling Northwoods-themed kitsch and faux antiques to attract vacationers. He remembered hauling Fredrickson's old blue horse trailer into Olson's gravel lot, the truck's rusted fenders flapping like an old person's jowls. He slowed to a stop in a cloud of yellow dust near the mouth of the red and white barn, by far the most successful boarding facility in the area. Its main door stood open to the sun, and its broad center aisle shone with the muted wood planking and bright silver bars of horse stalls. Bales of pine shavings were stacked on pallets just inside, and a delivery worker was loading his forklift back onto the end of his truck. J.W. turned to let the mare out and saw Carol and her friend Mary Beth walking toward the barn. "Hey," she said, with a little wave and a smile. Such personal acknowledgement was unexpected. But in that one wave, the notion that he could have this most desirable of girls shot through him. He could immediately imagine her smell, the feeling of her fine arms and hands, her hair on his face. His mind raced. Olson needed a younger trainer like J.W., he told the stable owner when he checked in the horse. It would help bring in the girls. Where the girls go, the families go, J.W. said. Olson knew it was true. Horses had mostly become a girl thing in recent years, and so Olson took J.W. up on his offer to work a week for free to see what he could do. By July, it had become a full-time summer job. He'd taken the girls off barn nags and put them on two of Olson's fancy show horses. He promised he wouldn't let the girls screw them up, and he worked with them in the riding ring out by the road, where two pretty girls bouncing on horseback brought in even more clients for the stable and its talented young trainer. By August, when Mary Beth went on a family vacation to the Wisconsin Dells, Carol came for private lessons. He took her on long trail rides through the thick grasses along the riverbed. They talked about life and their classmates as the water flowed by, thick and brown. Most of the time it was Carol doing the talking, and J.W. thrilled to feel her thigh brushing against him, or to direct her hand placement with his own. By the beginning of the school year, they had become a couple, throwing the town's social balance out of order. She told her friends that he was really smart, but despite what he would come to think of as her down-to-earthness, her crowd was one of speedboats, water skis, and downhill skiing trips to Spirit Mountain, or even Aspen, in the winters. Her friends were the children of the top executives from the paper mill and the former mine manager. J.W. had grown up in a four-room house, and the farthest he'd been was Fargo. Yet somehow, after a few weeks of gossip and consternation, he became cool, a token of their open-mindedness, and the social stratification of early high school began to fall away. He and Carol continued riding. He loved her sleek blonde hair, her plush pink lips, and the strange gray-blue pools of her round eyes. At night, they had exuberant sex, in the tack room, in an empty stall thick with pine shavings, in the changing rooms of horse trailers. He loved the sound of her gasping, rhythmic sighs. In the spring, he was invited to the Ingersoll home for dinner. Arguably the nicest house in town, it was a classic brick and clabbered two-story colonial with mini-mansion touches, the small white-columned front portico, 12-pane double-hung windows, and white-painted shutters. The interior had an enormous wood-paneled family room hung with brass rubbings from England and a high trompe-l'oeil ceiling painted like a summer sky. Mrs. Ingersoll kept fresh flowers in vases and plastic on the pale sofas in the living room. Carol and her younger brother Evan, who was 12, sat opposite J.W. at the Queen Anne dining table with Carol's parents, Bob and Mary, on either end. He remembered the light streaming through the lacy living room curtains and falling across the ashen blue carpeting. Mary's knife clicked faintly against her china as she quizzed him, the expanse of the living room opening up behind her. "Have you given much thought to what you're going to do? For a career?" "A little bit," he replied. "Right now I'm thinking about training horses." "He changes it weekly," added Carol. He felt his face redden at this betrayal. Mary smiled and went back to her carrots. "Well, sooner or later you'll have to pick one and stick with it, I suppose." "I know," said J.W. "You could be a horse trainer," Bob said from the other end of the table. The French doors to the sunroom stood open behind him. "But there isn't much money in it." "Yeah," said Evan, "like loser money." Carol elbowed him. "There's $10 an hour in it," J.W. said to the boy, suddenly defensive. He glanced toward Mr. Ingersoll. Maybe that's not much for a grown-up. Well, that's pretty good for a kid, especially these days, replied Bob, eyeing Evan. But you can't do it forever. And you probably want a better lifestyle. Have you thought about that? Not really. J.W. was adopting the aw shucks air of a hayseed, something he did when he was nervous. But he kicked himself for it and sat higher, adjusting his grip on his silverware. The key to making real money is to do something that helps people control their destiny. Mr. Ingersoll poked the air with his fork for emphasis, then went in for another bite of chicken. I guess I can see that, said J.W. Take your father, Mr. Ingersoll went on. He puts up cell phone towers, right? Sort of. He drives around and sells the leases. Even better. He helps people control their destiny by giving them power. He helps farmers make money off those leases, and he gives people power to make their lives better by having the convenience and safety of a cell phone. Do you see? My guess. J.W. had never really thought about his dad like that before, and he didn't think many other people did either. His dad was a traveling salesman who drank too much. You see? You give people choices, offered J.W. agreeably. He felt like a rube being polished up for the fair. Exactly. Choice is freedom. You work in a business that expands their ability to better their own lives. Horses used to do that. Then it was cars. Now it's cell phones. J.W. nodded and smiled. That's an interesting observation, he said. Carol crossed her eyes at him from behind her drumstick, as if to communicate that she'd heard these sorts of lectures many times. He was starting to forgive her. Maybe you should consider taking a job at the bank this coming summer, offered Mary. That helps people control their lives. Bob could introduce you to the president. She glanced at Bob, who shrugged and nodded. It wasn't like they had told him to do anything, J.W. thought as he drove home from Minneapolis. Yet in many ways, the strange kaitos of chance and emotion running through that dinner had laid the foundation for where he was now. The Ingersolls had set an expectation for the boy who was by chance dating their daughter, a certain standard he had to maintain. And so he took a summer job as a teller at the bank, letting his former life fall away like an old skin with hardly a look back. A lot of the girls who had been coming in for riding lessons on evenings and weekends instead began making small deposits and withdrawals during his shifts at the bank.
You have been listening to Episode 2 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 3 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.